Blind Sight, Disc 7.
Bates and the gang grew suddenly, subtly, still. James's affect seeped out over her body, supplanting Sasha's. Smoke curled from Cunningham's mouth and nose. There's nothing central about it, as it transpires. No cephalization, not even clustered sense organs. The body's covered with something like eye spots, or chromatophores, or both. There are CT everywhere. As far as I can tell, if all those little crooked filaments I've been able to put back together after your malfunction really are nerves and not something completely different, every one of those structures is under independent control. Bates sat up straight. Seriously? He nodded. It would be akin to independently controlling the movement of each individual hair on your head, although this creature is covered with little hairs from tip to tip. The same thing applies to the eyes. Hundreds of thousands of eyes all over the cuticle. Each one is barely more than a pinhole camera, but each is capable of independent focus, and I'm guessing all the different inputs integrate somewhere up the line. The entire body acts like a single diffuse retina. In theory, that gives it enormous visual acuity. A distributed telescope array, Bates murmured.
A chromatophore underlies each eye. The pigment's some kind of cryptochrome, so it's probably involved in vision.
A chromatophore underlies each eye. The pigment's some kind of cryptochrome, so it's probably involved in vision.
But it can also diffuse or contract through the local tissue.
That implies dynamic pigment patterns, like a squid or a chameleon. Background pattern matching? Bates asked. Would that explain why Siri couldn't see it? Cunningham opened a new window and played grained, loopy imagery of Siri Keaton and his unseen dance partner. The creature I hadn't noticed was ominously solid to the cameras, a floating discoid twice as wide as my own torso, arms extending from its edges like thick knotted ropes. Patterns rippled across its surface in waves, sunlight and shadow playing on a shallow seabed.
As you can see, the background doesn't match the pattern, Cunningham said. It's not even close.
Can you explain Siri's blindness to it? Saresti said.
I can't, Cunningham admitted. It's beyond ordinary crypsis. But Rorschach makes you see all sorts of things that aren't there. Not seeing something that is there might come down to essentially the same thing.
Another hallucination? I asked. Another shrug while Cunningham sucked smoke.
There are many ways to fool the human visual system. It's interesting that the illusion failed when multiple witnesses were present, but if you want a definitive mechanism, you'll have to give me more to work with than that.
He stabbed his cigarette hand at the crisped remains. But, James took a breath, bracing herself, we're talking about something sophisticated, at least, something very complex, a great deal of processing power. Cunningham nodded again.
I'd estimate nervous tissue accounts for about 30% of body mass.
So it's intelligent. Her voice was almost a whisper.
Not remotely.
But 30%,
30% motor and sensory wiring.
Another drag.
Much like an octopus. An enormous number of neurons, but half of them get used up running the suckers.
My understanding is that octopi are quite intelligent, James said.
By Molluscan standards, certainly. But do you have any idea how much extra cabling you'd need if the photoreceptors in your eye were spread across your entire body? You'd need about 300 million extension cords to begin with, ranging from half a millimeter to 2 meters long. Which means all your signals are staggered and out of sync, which means billions of additional logic gates to cohere the input. And that just gets you a single static image with no filtering, no interpretation, no time series integration at all.
Shiver. Drag.
Now multiply that by all the extra wiring you need to focus all those eye spots on an object,
or to send all that information back to individual chromatophores and then add in the processing power you need to drive those chromatophores one at a time. 30% might do all that, but I strongly doubt you'd have much left over for philosophy and science. He waved his hand in the general direction of the hold. That scrambler, James suggested. Cunningham rolled his tongue around it. Very well. That scrambler is an absolute miracle of evolutionary engineering. It's also dumb as a stick. A moment's silence.
So what is it? James asked at last. Somebody's pet?
Canary in a coal mine, Bates suggested. Perhaps not even that, Cunningham said. Perhaps no more than a white blood cell with Waldo's. Maintenance bot, maybe. Teleoperated or instinct-driven. But people, we're ignoring far greater questions here. How could an anaerobe even develop complex multicellular anatomy, much less move as fast as this thing did? That level of activity burns a great deal of ATP. Maybe they don't use ATP, Bates said as I thumbnailed. Adenosine triphosphate, cellular energy source. It was crammed with ATP, Cunningham told her. You can tell that much even with these remains. The question is, how can it synthesize the stuff fast enough to keep up with demand? Purely anaerobic pathways wouldn't suffice. Nobody offered any suggestions. Anyway, he said, so endeth the lesson. If you want gory details, check consensus. He wiggled the fingers of his free hand. The spectral dissection vanished. I'll keep working, but if you want any real answers, go get me a live one. He butted out his cigarette against the bulkhead and stared defiantly around the drum. The others hardly reacted. Their topologies still sparkled from the revelations of a few minutes before. Perhaps Cunningham's pet peeve was more important to the big picture. Perhaps in a reductionist universe, biochemical basics should always take priority over the finer points of ETI and interspecies etiquette. But Bates and the gang were time-lagged, processing earlier revelations. Not just processing, either. Wallowing. They clung to Cunningham's findings like convicted felons who just discovered they might be freed on a technicality. Because the scrambler was dead on our hands, no doubt about it. But it wasn't an alien, not really. It wasn't intelligent. It was just a blood cell with Waldo's. It was dumb as a stick. And property damage is so much easier to live with than murder. Problems cannot be solved at the same level of awareness that created them. Albert Einstein. Robert Paglino had set me up with Chelsea in the first place. Maybe he felt responsible when the relationship started jumping the rails, or maybe Chelsea, Madame Fixit that she was, had approached him for an intervention. For whatever reason, it was obvious the moment we took our seats at Cubitt's that his invitation had not been entirely social. He went for some neurotrope cocktail on the rocks. I stuck with Ricard's. Still old school, Pag said. Still into foreplay, I observed. That obvious, huh? He took a sip. That'll teach me to try the subtle approach with a professional jargonaut. Jargonaut's got nothing to do with it. You wouldn't have fooled a border collie. Truth be told, Pag's topology never really told me much that I didn't already know. I never really had much of an edge in reading him. Maybe we just knew each other too well. So, he said. Spill. Nothing to spill. She just got to know the real me. That is bad. What'd she tell you? Me? Nothing at all. I gave him a look over the top of my glass. He sighed. She knows you're cheating on her. I'm what? Cheating with the skin. It's based on her. But it isn't her. No, it isn't. It doesn't fart or fight or break into tears every time you don't want to be dragged off to meet its family. Look, I love the woman dearly, but come on. When was the last time you tried first-person fucking? 74, he said. You're kidding. I'd have guessed never. Did some third world medical missionary work between gigs. They still bump and grind in Texas. Pag swigged his trope. Actually, I thought it was all right. The novelty wears off. Evidently. And it's not like I'm doing anything unusual here, Pag. She's the one with the kink. And it's not just the sex. She keeps asking about... She keeps wanting to know things. Like what? Irrelevant stuff. My life as a kid. My family. Nobody's fucking business. She's just taking an interest. Not everyone considers childhood memories off limits, you know. Thanks for the insight. As if people had never taken an interest before. As if Helen hadn't taken an interest when she went through my drawers and filtered my mail and followed me from room to room, asking the drapes and the furniture why I was always so sullen and withdrawn. She'd taken such an interest that she wouldn't let me out the door until I confided in her. At 12, I'd been stupid enough to throw myself on her mercy. It's personal, Mom. I'd just rather not talk about it. Then I'd made my escape into the bathroom when she demanded to know if it was trouble online, trouble at school. Was it a girl? Was it a boy? What was it, and why couldn't I just trust my own mother? Don't I know I can trust her with anything? I waited out the persistent knocking and the insistent, concerned voice through the door and the final grudging silence that followed. I waited until I was absolutely sure she'd gone away. I waited for 5 fucking hours before I came out, and there she was, arms folded in the hall, eyes brimming with reproach and disappointment. That night, she took the lock off the bathroom door because family should never shut each other out. Still taking an interest. Siri, Peg said quietly. I slowed my breathing, tried again. She doesn't just want to talk about family. She wants to meet them. She keeps trying to drag me to meet hers. I thought I was hooking up with Chelsea, you know? Nobody ever told me I'd have to share airspace with... You do it? Once. Reaching, grasping things, feigning acceptance, feigning friendship.
It was great, if you like, being ritually pawed by a bunch of play-acting strangers who can't stand the sight of you and don't have the guts to admit it.
Pag shrugged, unsympathetic. Sounds like typical old-school family. You're a synthesis, man. You deal with way wonkier dynamics than that. I deal with other people's information. I don't vomit my own personal life into the public sphere. Whatever hybrids and the constructs I work with, they don't... Touch. Interrogate, I finished. You knew Chelsea was an old-fashioned girl right off the top. Yeah, when it suits her. I gulped ale. But she's cutting edge when she's got a splicer in her hand, which isn't to say that her strategies couldn't use some work. Strategies. It's not a strategy, for God's sake. Can't you see I'm hurting? I'm on the fucking floor, Siri. I'm curled up in a ball because I'm hurting so much and all you can do is criticize my tactics? What do I have to do, slash my goddamn wrists? I'd shrugged and turned away. Nature's trick. She cries, I said now. High blood lactate levels makes it easy for her. It's just chemistry, but she holds it up like it was some kind of IOU. Pag pursed his lips. Doesn't mean it's an act. Everything's an act. Everything's strategy. You know that. I snorted. And she's miffed because I base a skin on her? I don't think it's so much the actual skin as the fact that you didn't tell her. You know how she feels about honesty in relationships? Sure, she doesn't want any. He looked at me. Give me some credit, Peg. You think I should tell her that sometimes the sight of her makes me shudder? The system called Robert Paglino sat quietly and sipped his drugs and set the things he was about to say in order. He took a breath. I can't believe you could be so fucking dumb, he said. Yeah? Enlighten me. Of course she wants you to tell her you only have eyes for her. You love her pores and her morning breath. And why stop at one tweak? How about 10? But that doesn't mean she wants you to lie, you idiot. She wants all that stuff to be true. And,
Well, why can't it be?
It isn't, I said.
Jesus, Siri, people aren't rational. You aren't rational. We're not thinking machines. We're feeling machines that happen to think.
He took a breath and another hit.
And you already know that, or you couldn't do your job. Or at least,
he grimaced,
the system knows.
The system. Me and my protocols, he meant. My Chinese room. I took a breath.
It doesn't work with everyone, you know.
So I've noticed. Can't read systems you're too entangled with, right? Observer effect. I shrugged.
Just as well, he said. I don't think I'd like you all that much in that room of yours.
It came out before I could stop it. Chell said she'd prefer a real one. He raised his eyebrows.
Real what?
Chinese room. She says it would have better comprehension. The cube murmured and clattered around us for a few moments.
I can see why she'd say that, Pag said at last. But you did okay, Podman.
I don't know. He nodded, emphatic.
You know what they say about the road less traveled? Well, you carved your own road. I don't know why. It's like learning calligraphy using your toes, you know? Or proprioperceptive polyneuropathy. It's amazing you can do it at all. It's mind-boggling that you actually got good at it.
I squinted at him.
There used to be people without any sense of, well, of themselves, physically. They couldn't feel their bodies in space, had no idea how their own limbs were arranged, or even if they had limbs. Some of them said they felt pithed, disembodied. They'd send a motor signal to the hand and just have to take it on faith that it arrived. So they'd use vision to compensate. They couldn't feel where the hand was, so they'd look at it while it moved, use sight as a substitute for the normal force feedback you and I take for granted. They could walk if they kept their eyes focused on their legs and concentrated on every step. They'd get pretty good at it. But even after years of practice, if you distracted them in mid-step, they'd go over like a beanstalk without a counterweight.
You're saying I'm like that.
You use your Chinese room the way they used vision. You've reinvented empathy, almost from scratch, and in some ways, not all, obviously, or I wouldn't have to tell you this, but in some ways, yours is better than the original. It's why you're so good at synthesis.
I shook my head.
I just observe, that's all. I watch what people do, and then I imagine what would make them do that.
Sounds like empathy to me.
It's not. Empathy's not so much about imagining how the other guy feels. It's more about imagining how you'd feel in the same place, right?
Pag frowned.
So?
So what if you don't know how you'd feel? He looked at me, and his surfaces were serious and completely transparent.
You're better than that, friend. You may not always act like it, but I know you. I knew you before.
You knew someone else. I'm Podman, remember?
Yeah, that was someone else, and maybe I remember him better than you do, but I'll tell you one thing.
He leaned forward.
Both of you would have helped me out that day, and maybe he would have got there with good old-fashioned empathy while you had to cobble together some kind of improvised flowchart out of surplus parts, but that just makes your accomplishment all the greater. Which is why I continue to stick it out with you, old buddy. Even though you have a rod up your ass the size of the Rio Spire.
He held out his glass. Dutifully, I clinked it against my own. We drank.
I don't remember him, I said after a while.
What, the other Siri? Pre-pod Siri?
I nodded.
Nothing at all?
I thought back.
Well, he was racked by convulsions all the time, right? There'd be constant pain. I don't remember any pain.
My glass was almost empty. I sipped to make it last.
I dream about him sometimes, though. About being him.
What's it like?
It was colorful. Everything was more saturated, you know? Sounds, smells,
richer than life.
And now?
I looked at him. You said it was colorful. What changed?
I don't know. Maybe nothing. I don't actually remember the dreams when I wake up anymore.
So how do you know you still have them? Pag asked.
Fuck it, I thought, and tipped back the last of my pint in a single gulp. I know.
How?
I frowned, taken aback. I had to think for a few moments before I remembered.
I wake up smiling, I said.
Grunts look the enemy in the eye. Grunts know the stakes. Grunts know the price of poor strategy. What do the generals know? Overlays and tactical plots. The whole chain of command is upside down. Kenneth Lubin, Zero Sum. It went bad from the moment we breached. The plan had called for precise havoc along the new beachhead, subtly arranged to entrap some blood cell with Waldo's just as it sought to repair the damage. Our job had been to set the trap and stand back, trusting Saristi's assurances that we would not have long to wait. We had no time at all. Something squirmed in the swirling dust the moment we breached, serpentine movement down the hole that instantly kicked Bates' renowned field initiative into high gear. Her grunts dived through and caught a scrambler twitching in their crosshairs, clinging to the wall of the passageway. It must have been stunned by the blast of our entry, a classic case of wrong place, wrong time. Bates took a split second to appraise the opportunity, and the plan was plasma. One of the grunts plugged the scrambler with a biopsy dart before I even had a chance to blink. We would have bagged the whole animal right then if Rorschach's magnetosphere hadn't chosen that moment to kick sand in our faces. As it was, by the time our grunts staggered back into action, their quarry was already disappearing around the bend. Bates was tethered to her troops. They yanked her down the rabbit hole. "Set it up," she yelled back at Sasha, the moment she let them loose. I was tethered to Bates. I barely had a chance to exchange a wide-eyed look with Sasha before being yanked away in turn. Suddenly I was inside again. The sated biopsy dart bounced off my faceplate and flashed past, still attached to a few meters of discarded monofilament. Hopefully Sasha would pick it up while Bates and I were hunting. At least the mission wouldn't be a total loss if we never made it back. The grunts dragged us like bait on a hook. Bates flew like a dolphin just ahead of me, keeping effortlessly to the center of the bore with an occasional tweak of her jets. I careened off walls just behind, trying to stabilize myself, trying to look as though I too might be in control. It was an important pretense. The whole point of being a decoy is to pass yourself off as an original. They'd even given me my own gun. Pure precaution, of course, more for comfort than protection. It hugged my forearm and fired plastic slugs impervious to induction fields. Just Bates and I now, a pacifist soldier, and the odds of a coin toss. Gooseflesh prickled my skin as it always had. The usual ghosts scrabbled and clawed through my mind. This time, though, the dread seemed muted, distant. Perhaps it was just a matter of timing. Perhaps we were moving so quickly through the magnetic landscape that no one phantom had a chance to stick. Or maybe it was something else. Maybe I wasn't so afraid of ghosts, because this time we were after monsters. The scrambler seemed to have thrown off whatever cobwebs our entrance had spun. It surged along the walls now at full speed, its arms shooting ahead like a succession of striking snakes, slinging the body forward so fast the drones could barely keep it in sight, a writhing silhouette in the fog. Suddenly it leapt sideways, sailing across the width of the passageway and down some minor tributary. The grunts veered in pursuit, crashing into walls, stumbling, stopping, and suddenly Bates was braking hard, shooting back past me as I flailed with my pistol. I was past the drones, and the next instant, my leash snapped tight and snapped back, bringing me to a dead, drifting stop. For a second or two, I was on the front line. For a second or two, I was the front line. Siri Keaton, note-taker, mole, professional uncomprehender. I just floated there, breath roaring in my helmet, as a few meters farther on, the walls squirmed, peristalsis, I thought at first, but this motion was utterly unlike the slow, undulating waves that usually rippled along Rorschach's passageways. So hallucination, I thought instead. And then those writhing walls reached out with 1,000 whip-like calcareous tongues that grabbed our quarry from every direction and tore it to pieces. Something grabbed me and spun me around. Suddenly I was locked against the chest of one of the grunts, its rear guns firing as we retreated back up the tunnel at full speed. Bates was in the arms of the other. Seething motion receded behind us, but the image stayed stuck to the backs of my eyes, hallucinatory and point-blank in its clarity. Scramblers everywhere. A seething infestation squirming across the walls, reaching out for the intruder, leaping into the lumen of the passageway to press their counterattack. Not against us. They had attacked one of their own. I'd seen three of its arms ripped off before it had disappeared into a writhing ball in the center of the passageway. We fled. I turned to Bates. "Did you see?" but held my tongue.
The deathly concentration on her face was unmistakable, even across 2 faceplates and 3 meters of methane.
According to HUD, she'd lobotomized both grunts, bypassed all that wonderful autonomous decision-making circuitry entirely. She was running both machines herself, as manually as marionettes. Grainy, turbulent echoes appeared on the rear sonar display. The scramblers had finished with their sacrifice. Now they were coming after us. My grunt stumbled and careened against the side of the passage. Jagged shards of alien decor dug parallel gouges across my faceplate, tenderized chunks of thigh through the shielded fabric of my suit. I clenched down on a cry. It got out anyway. Some ridiculous in-suit alarm chirped indignantly an instant before 12 rotten eggs broke open inside my helmet. I coughed, my eyes stung and watered in the reek. I could barely see sieverts on the HUD flashing instantly into the red. Bates drove us on without a word. My faceplate healed enough to shut off the alarm. My air began to clear. The scramblers had gained. By the time I could see clearly again, they were only a few meters behind us. Up ahead, Sasha came into view around the bend, Sasha who had no backup, whose other cores had all been shut down on Saresti's orders. Susan had protested at first. "If there's any opportunity to communicate, there won't be," he'd said. So there was Sasha, who was more resistant to Rorschach's influence, according to some criterion I never understood, curled up in a fetal ball with her gloves clamped against her helmet, and I could only hope to some dusty deity that she'd set the trap before this place had got to her. And here came the scramblers, and Bates was shouting, "Sasha, get out of the fucking way!" and breaking hard, way too soon, the scrambling horde nipping at our heels like a riptide, and Bates yelled, "Sasha!" again, and finally Sasha moved, kicked herself into gear and off the nearest wall, and fled right back up the hole we'd blown in through. Bates yanked some joystick in her head, and our warrior sedan slewed and shat sparks and bullets and dove out after her. Sasha had set the trap just within the mouth of the breach. Bates armed it in passing with a slap of one gloved hand. Motion sensors were supposed to do the rest, but the enemy was close behind and there was no room to spare. It went off just as I was emerging into the vestibule. The cannon net shot out behind me in a glorious exploding conic, caught something, snapped back up the rabbit hole, and slammed into my grunt from behind. The recoil kicked us against the top of the vestibule so hard I thought the fabric would tear. It held and threw us back against the squirming things enmeshed in our midst. Writhing backbones everywhere, articulated arms lashing like bony whips. One of them entwined my leg and squeezed like a brick python. Bates's hands waved in a frantic dance before me, and that arm came apart into dismembered segments, bouncing around the enclosure. This was all wrong. They were supposed to be in the net. They were supposed to be contained. "Sasha, launch!" Bates barked. Another arm separated from its body and careened into the wall, coiling and uncoiling. The hole had flooded with aerosol foam core as soon as we'd pulled the net. A scrambler writhed half embedded in that matrix, caught just a split second too late. Its central mass protruded like some great round tumor writhing with monstrous worms. "Sasha!" Artillery. The floor of the vestibule irised shut quick as a leg-hold trap, and everything slammed against it, grunts, people, scramblers whole and in pieces. I couldn't breathe. Every thimbleful of flesh weighed 100 kilograms. Something slapped us to one side, a giant hand batting an insect. Maybe a course correction, maybe a collision, but 10 seconds later, we were weightless again, and nothing had torn us open. We floated like mites in a ping-pong ball, surrounded by a confusion of machinery and twitching body parts. There was little of anything that might pass for blood. What there was floated in clear, shuddering spherules. The cannon net floated like a shrink-wrapped asteroid in our midst. The things inside had wrapped their arms around themselves, around each other, curled into a shivering and unresponsive ball. Compressed methonia hissed around them, keeping them fresh for the long trip home. "Holy shit," Sasha breathed, watching them. "The bloodsucker called it." He hadn't called everything. He hadn't called a mob of multi-armed aliens ripping one of their own to pieces before my eyes. He hadn't seen that coming. Or at least he hadn't mentioned it. I was already feeling nauseous. Bates was carefully bringing her wrists together. For a moment, I could barely make out a taut dark thread of freak wire, fine as smoke, between them. Her caution was well advised. That stuff would slice through human limbs as easily as alien ones. One of our grunts groomed its mouthparts at her shoulder, cleaning gore from its mandibles. The freak wire vanished from my sight. Sight itself was dimming now. The inside of this great lead balloon was going dark around me. We were coasting, purely ballistic. We had to trust that Scylla would swoop in and snatch us once we'd achieved a discreet distance from the scene of the crime. We had to trust Saresti. That was getting harder by the hour. But he'd been right so far. Mostly. "How do you know?" Bates had asked when he'd first laid out the plan. He hadn't answered. Chances are he couldn't have, not to us, any more than a baseline could have explained brain theory to the inhabitants of Flatland. But Bates hadn't been asking about tactics anyway, not really. Maybe she'd been asking for a reason, for something to justify this ongoing trespass into foreign soil, the capture and slaughter of its natives. On one level, she already knew the reason, of course. We all did. We could not afford to merely react. The risks were too great. We had to preempt. Saresti, wise beyond all of us, saw this more clearly than we. Amanda Bates knew he was right in her mind, but perhaps she didn't feel it in her gut. Perhaps, I thought as my vision failed, she was asking Saresti to convince her. But that wasn't all she was doing. Imagine you are Amanda Bates. The control you wield over your troops would give wet dreams and nightmares to generals of ages past. You can drop instantly into the sensorium of anyone under your command, experience the battlefield from any number of first-person perspectives. Your every soldier is loyal unto death, asking no questions, obeying all commands with alacrity and dedication to which mere flesh could never even aspire. You don't just respect a chain of command, you are one. You are a little bit scared of your own power. You are a little bit scared of the things you've already done with it. Taking orders comes as naturally as giving them. Oh, you've been known to question policy on occasion, or seek a bigger picture than may be strictly necessary for the job at hand. Your command initiative has become the stuff of legends, but you have never disobeyed a direct order. When asked for your perspective, you serve it straight up and unvarnished, until the decision is made and the orders handed down. Then you do your job without question. Even when questions arise, you would hardly waste time asking them unless you expected an answer you could use. Why, then, demand analytical details from a vampire? Not for information. Might as well expect the sighted to explain vision to the congenitally blind. Not for clarification. There was no ambiguity in Saresti's bottom line. Not even for the benefit of poor dumb Ciri Keaton, who may have missed some salient point but is too ashamed to raise his own hand. No, there is only one reason why you might ask for such details. To challenge, to rebel, to the infinitesimal degree that rebellion is permitted once the word is given. You argued and advocated as forcefully as you could back when Saraste was soliciting input, but he ignored yours, abandoned any attempt at communication, and preemptively invaded foreign territory. He knew that Rorschach might contain living beings, and still he tore it open without regard for their welfare. He may have killed helpless innocents. He may have roused an angry giant. You don't know. All you know is you've been helping him do it. You've seen this kind of arrogance before among your own kind. You had hoped that smarter creatures would be wiser ones. Bad enough to see such arrogant stupidity inflicted on the helpless, but to do it at these stakes beggars belief. Killing innocents is the least of the risks you're running. You're gambling with the fate of worlds, provoking conflict with a star-faring technology whose sole offense was to take your picture without permission. Your dissent has changed nothing, so you rein it in. All that slips out now is the occasional pointless question with no hope of an answer, its inherent insubordination so deeply buried you don't even see it yourself. If you did see it, you'd keep your mouth shut entirely, because the last thing you want is to remind Saraste that you think he's wrong. You don't want him dwelling on that. You don't want him to think you're up to something. Because you are, even if you're not quite ready to admit it to yourself. A man debates, is beginning to contemplate a change of command. The laceration of my suit had done a real number on the gears. It took 3 solid days for Theseus to bring me back to life. But death was no excuse for falling behind the curve. I resurrected with a head full of updates clogging my inlays. I flipped through them, climbing down into the drum. The gang of 4 sat at the galley below me, staring at untouched portions of nutritionally balanced sludge on her plate. Cunningham, over in his inherited domain, grunted at my appearance and turned back to work, the fingers of one hand tapping compulsively on the desktop. Theseus's orbit had widened during my absence, and most of its eccentricities had been planed away. Now we kept our target in view from a more or less constant range of 3,000 kilometers. Our orbital period lagged Rorschach's by an hour. The alien crept implacably ahead of us along its lower trajectory, but a supplementary burn every couple of weeks would be enough to keep it in sight. We had specimens now, things to be examined under conditions of our own choosing. No point in risking any more close approaches until we'd wrung every useful datum from what we had. Cunningham had expanded his lab space during my time in the sepulchre. He'd built holding pens, one for each scrambler, modules partitioned by a common wall and installed in a whole new hab. The microwaved carcass had been sidelined like a discarded toy from a previous birthday, although according to the access logs, Cunningham still visited it every now and then. Not that he visited any part of the new wing in person, of course. Not that he was even able to, not without suiting up and jumping across the hold. The whole compartment had been disconnected from its spinal lock and pushed to a tethered anchorage midway between spine and carapace. Saraste's orders, given to minimize risk of contamination. It was no skin off Cunningham's nose. He was happier leaving his body in pseudo-gravity anyway, while his consciousness flitted between the Waldos and sensors and bric-a-brac surrounding his new pets. Theseus saw me coming and pushed a squeeze bulb of sugary electrolytes from the galley dispenser. The gang didn't look up as I passed. One forefinger tapped absently against their temple, the lips pursed and twitched in the characteristic mode that said, internal dialogue in progress. I could never tell who was on top when they were like that. I sucked on the squeeze bulb and looked in on the pens. 2 cubes suffused in pale red light. In one, a scrambler floated center stage, waving its segmented arms like seaweed in gentle surge. The occupant of the other cage was squeezed into a corner, four arms splayed across the converging walls, four others extended, waving again into open space. The bodies from which those arms sprouted were spheroids, not flattened disks as our first sample had been. They were only slightly compressed, and their arms sprouted not from a single equatorial band, but from across the whole surface. Fully extended, the floating scrambler was over 2 meters across. The other seemed roughly the same size. Neither moved, except for those drifting arms. Navy blue mosaics, almost black in the long wave, rippled across their surfaces like the patterns of wind on grass. Superimposed graphics plotted methane and hydrogen at reassuring Rorschach norms. Temperatures and lighting, ditto. An icon for ambient electromagnetics remained dark. I dipped into the archives, watched the arrival of the aliens from 2 days past, each tumbling unceremoniously into its pen, balled up, hugging themselves as they bounced gently around their enclosures. Fetal position, I thought. But after a few moments, the arms uncoiled, like the blooming of calcareous flowers. "Robert says Rorschach grows them," Susan said behind me. I turned. Definitely James in there, but muted somehow. Her meal remained untouched. Her surfaces were dim. Except for the eyes. Those were deep and a little hollow. "Grows?" I repeated. "In stacks. They have 2 navels each." She managed a weak smile, touched her belly with one hand and the small of her back with the other. "One in front, one behind. He thinks they grow in a kind of column, piled up. When the top one develops to a certain point, it buds off from the stack and becomes free-living." The archived scramblers were exploring their new environment now, climbing gingerly along the walls, unrolling their arms along the corners where the panels met. Those swollen central bodies struck me again. "So that first one, with the flattened juvenile," she agreed, "fresh off the stack. These ones are older. They plump out as they mature, Robert says," she added after a moment. I sucked the dregs from my squeeze bulb. "The ship grows its own crew." "If it's a ship," James shrugged, "if they're a crew." I watched them move. There wasn't much to explore. The walls were almost bare, innocent of anything but a few sensor heads and gas nozzles. The pens had their own tentacles and manipulators for more invasive research needs, but those had been carefully sheathed during introduction. Still, the creatures covered the territory in careful increments, moving back and forth along parallel invisible paths, almost as if they were running transects. James had noticed it too. "Seems awfully systematic, doesn't it?" "What does Robert say about that?" "He says the behavior of honeybees and sphex wasps is just as complex, and it's all rote hardwiring, not intelligence." "But bees still communicate, right? They do that dance to tell the hive where the flowers are?" She shrugged, conceding the point. "So you still might be able to talk to those things." "Maybe. You'd think." She massaged her brow between thumb and forefinger. "We haven't got anywhere, though. We played some of their pigment patterns back to them with variations. They don't seem to make sounds. Robert synthesized a bunch of noises that they might squeeze out of their cloacae if they were so inclined, but those didn't get us anywhere either. Harmonic farts, really." "So we're sticking to the blood cells with Waldo's model." "Pretty much. But you know, they didn't go into a loop. Hardwired animals repeat themselves. Even smart ones pace or chew their fur. Stereotyped behaviors. But these two, they gave everything a very careful once-over and then just shut down." They were still at it in consensus, slithering across one wall, then another, a slow screw-thread track that would leave no square centimeter uncovered. "Have they done anything since?" I asked. She shrugged again. "Nothing spectacular. They squirm when you poke them, wave their arms back and forth. They do that pretty much constantly, but there's no information in it that we can tell. They haven't gone invisible on us or anything. We blanked the adjoining wall for a while so they could see each other, even piped audio and air feeds. Robert thought there might be some kind of pheromonal communication, but nothing. They didn't even react to each other." "Have you tried, well, motivating them?" "With what, Siri?" "They don't seem to care about their own company. We can't bribe them with food unless we know what they eat, which we don't. Robert says they're in no immediate danger of starvation anyway. Maybe when they get hungry, they can deal." I killed the archival feed and reverted to real time. "Maybe they eat, I don't know, radiation or magnetic energy. The cage can generate magnetic fields, right?" "Tried it." She took a breath and squared her shoulders. "But I guess these things take time. He's only had a couple of days, and I only got out of the crypt myself a day ago. We'll keep trying." "What about negative reinforcement?" I wondered. She blinked. "Hurt them, you mean?" "Not necessarily anything extreme. And if they're not sentient anyway..." Just like that, Susan went away. "Why, Keaton, you just made a suggestion. You giving up on this whole non-interference thing?" "Hello, Sasha. No, of course not. Just making a list of what's been tried." "Good." There was an edge to her voice. "Hate to think you were slipping. We're going to grab some downtime now, so maybe you could go and talk to Cunningham for a bit. Yeah, do that. And be sure to tell him your theory about radiation-eating aliens. I bet he could use a laugh." He stood at his post in Biomed, though his empty chair was barely a meter away. The ubiquitous cigarette hung from between the fingers of one hand. Burned down and burned out. His other hand played with itself, fingers tapping against thumb in sequence, little to index, index to little. Windows crawled with intelligence in front of him. He wasn't watching. I approached from behind. I watched his surfaces in motion. I heard the soft syllables rising from his throat. Yitbarav yishtabav yitbarav yitramam. Not his usual litany. Not even his usual language, Hebrew, consensus said. It sounded almost like a prayer. He must have heard me. His topology went flat and hard and almost impossible to decipher. It was increasingly difficult getting a fix on anyone these days. But even through all these topological cataracts, Cunningham, as always, was a tougher read than most. "Keaton," he said without turning. "You're not Jewish," I said. "It was." Spindle, I realized after a moment. Cunningham didn't do gender pronouns. But Isaac Spindle had been an atheist, all of us were. We'd all started out that way, at least. "I didn't know you knew him," I said. "It certainly wasn't policy." Cunningham sank into his chair without looking at me. In his head and in mine, a new window opened within a frame marked electrophoresis. I tried again. "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. What can I do for you, Siri?" "I was hoping you could bring me up to speed on your findings." A periodic chart of alien elements scrolled through the feed. Cunningham logged it and started another sample. "I've documented everything. It's all in consensus." I made a play for ego. "It would really help to know how you'd thumbnailed it, though. What you think is important can be just as vital as the data themselves." He looked at me a moment. He muttered something repetitive and irrelevant. "What's important is what's missing," he said after a moment. "I've got good samples now and I still can't find the genes. Protein synthesis is almost prionic, reconfirmation instead of the usual transcription pathways, but I can't figure out how those bricks get slotted into the wall once they're made." Any progress on the energy front? I asked.
Energy?
Aerobic metabolism on an anaerobe budget, remember? You said they had too much ATP.
That I solved.
He puffed smoke. Far to stern, a fleck of alien tissue liquefied and banded into chemical strata.
They're sprinting.
Rotate that, if you can. I couldn't. How do you mean?
He sighed. Biochemistry is a trade-off. The faster you synthesize ATP, the more expensive each molecule becomes. It turns out scramblers are a lot more energy efficient at making it than we are. They're just extremely slow at it, which might not be a big drawback for something that spends most of its time inactive. Rorschach, whatever Rorschach started out as, could have drifted for millennia before it washed up here. That's a lot of time to build up an energy reserve for bouts of high activity, and once you've laid the groundwork, glycosis is explosive. 2,000-fold boost and no oxygen demand.
Scramblers sprint their whole lives.
They may come preloaded with ATP and burn it off throughout their lifespan.
How long would that be?
Good question, he admitted. Live fast, die young. If they ration it out, stay dormant most of the time. Who knows?
Huh. The free-floating scrambler had drifted away from the center of its pen. One extended arm held a wall at bay. The others continued their hypnotic swaying. I remembered other arms, their motion not so gentle. Amanda and I chased one into a crowd. Cunningham was back at his samples.
I saw the record.
They tore it to pieces.
Uh-huh.
Any idea why?
He shrugged. Bates thought there might be some kind of civil war going on down there.
What do you think?
I don't know. Maybe it's right, or maybe scramblers or ritual cannibals, or...
They're aliens, Keaton. What do you want from me? But they're not really aliens, at least not intelligent ones. War implies intelligence.
Ants wage war all the time. Proves nothing except they're alive.
Are scramblers even alive? I asked.
What kind of question is that?
You think Rorschach grows them on some kind of assembly line? You can't find any genes. Maybe they're just biomechanical machines.
That's what life is, Keaton. That's what you are.
Another hit of nicotine, another storm of numbers, another sample.
Life isn't either or. It's a matter of degree.
What I'm asking is, are they natural? Could they be constructs?
Is a termite mound a construct? Beaver dam? Spaceship? Of course. Were they built by naturally evolved organisms acting naturally? They were. So tell me how anything in the whole deep multiverse can ever be anything but natural.
I tried to keep the irritation out of my voice. You know what I mean.
It's a meaningless question. Get your head out of the 20th century.
I gave up. After a few seconds, Cunningham seemed to notice the silence. He withdrew his consciousness from the machinery and looked around with fleshly eyes, as if searching for some mosquito that had mysteriously stopped whining. What's your problem with me? I asked. Stupid question. Obvious question. Unworthy of any synthesis to be so direct. His eyes glittered in that dead face.
Processing without comprehension, that's what you do, isn't it?
That's a colossal oversimplification. Cunningham nodded.
Then why can't you seem to comprehend how pointless it is to keep peeking over our shoulders and writing home to our masters?
Someone has to keep Earth in the loop.
7 months each way. Long loop.
Still,
we're on our own out here, Keaton. You're on your own. The game's going to be over long before our masters even know it's started.
He sucked smoke.
Or perhaps not. Perhaps you're talking to someone closer, That it? Is the fourth wave telling you what to do?
There is no fourth wave. Not that anyone's told me, anyway.
Probably not. They'd never risk their lives out here, would they? Too dangerous even to hang back and watch from a distance. That's why they built us.
We're all self-made. Nobody forced you to get the rewire.
No, nobody forced me to get the rewire. I could have just let them cut out my brain and pack it into heaven, couldn't I? That's the choice we have. We can be utterly useless, or we can try and compete against vampires and the constructs and the AIs. And perhaps you could tell me how to do that without turning into an utter freak.
So much in the voice, nothing at all on the face. I said nothing.
See what I mean?
No comprehension. He managed a tight smile. So I'll answer your questions. I'll delay my own work and hold your hand because Sarastis told us to. I guess that superior vampire mind sees some legitimate reason to indulge your constant ankle-nipping, and it's in charge, so I'll play along. But I'm not nearly that smart, so you'll forgive me if it all seems a bit naff.
You're just doing your job. I know. But I don't like being played, Keaton. And that's what your job is.
Even back on Earth, Robert Cunningham had barely disguised his opinion of the ship's commissar. It had been obvious even to the topologically blind. I'd always had a hard time imagining the man. It wasn't just his expressionless face. Sometimes not even the subtler things behind would show up in his topology. Perhaps he repressed them deliberately, resenting the presence of this mole among the crew. It would hardly have been the first time I'd encountered such a reaction. Everyone resented me to some extent. Oh, they liked me well enough, or thought they did. They tolerated my intrusions and cooperated, and gave away far more than they thought they did. But beneath Spindle's gruff camaraderie, beneath James's patient explanations, there was no real respect. How could there be? These people were the bleeding edge, the incandescent apex of hominid achievement. They were trusted with the fate of the world. I was just a tattletale for small minds back home. Not even that much, when home receded too deeply in the distance. Superfluous mass. Couldn't be helped. No use getting bothered over it. Still, Spindle had only coined commissar half-jokingly. Cunningham believed it and didn't laugh. And while I'd encountered many others like him over the years, those had only tried to hide themselves from sight. Cunningham was the first who seemed to succeed. I tried to build the relationship all the way through training, tried to find the missing pieces. I watched him working the simulator's teleops one day, exercising the shiny new interfaces that spread him through walls and wires. He was practicing his surgical skills on some hypothetical alien the computer had conjured up to test his technique. Sensors and jointed teleops sprouted like the legs of an enormous spider crab from an overhead mount. Spirit-possessed, they dipped and weaved around some semi-plausible holographic creature. Cunningham's own body merely trembled slightly, a cigarette jiggling at the corner of its mouth. I waited for him to take a break. Eventually the tension ebbed from his shoulders, his vicarious limbs relaxed. "So," I tapped my temple, "why'd you do it?" He didn't turn. Above the dissection, sensors swiveled and stared back like dismembered eye stalks. That was the center of Cunningham's awareness right now, not this nicotine-stained body in front of me. Those were his eyes, or his tongue, or whatever unimaginable bastard senses he used to parse what the machine sent him. Those clusters aimed back at me, at us, and if Robert Cunningham still possessed anything that might be called vision, he was watching himself from eyes 2 meters outside his own skull.
"Do what, exactly?" he said at last. "The enhancements?"
Enhancements, as though he'd upgraded his wardrobe instead of ripping out his senses and grafting new ones into the wounds. I nodded.
"It's vital to keep current," he said.
If you don't reconfigure, you can't retrain. If you don't retrain, you're obsolete inside a month, and then you're not much good for anything except heaven or dictation. I ignored the jibe. Pretty radical transformation, though. Not these days. Didn't it change you? His body dragged on the cigarette. Targeted ventilation sucked away the smoke before it reached me. That's the whole point.
Surely you were affected
personally, though. Surely, He nodded. At the far end of shared motor nerves, teleops jiggled in sympathy. Change the eyes that look at the world, change the me that does the looking. Something like that. Now he was watching me with fleshly eyes. Across the membrane, those snakes and eye stalks returned to their work on the virtual carcass, as if deciding they'd wasted enough time on pointless distractions. I wondered which body he was in now.
I'm surprised you'd have to ask, the meat one said. Doesn't my body language tell you everything? Aren't jargonauts supposed to read minds?
He was right, of course. I wasn't interested in Cunningham's words. Those were just the carrier wave. He couldn't hear the real conversation we were having. All his angles and surfaces spoke volumes, and although their voices were strangely fuzzed with feedback and distortion, I knew I'd be able to understand them eventually. I only had to keep him talking. But Yuka Saraste chose that moment to wander past and surgically trash my best-laid plans.
Siri's best in his field, he remarked, but not when it gets too close to home.
Why should man expect his prayer for mercy to be heard by what is above him when he shows no mercy to what is under him? Pierre Trubetskoy. The thing is, Chelsea said, this whole first-person thing takes effort. You have to care enough to try, you know? I've been working my ass off on this relationship. I've been working so hard, but you just don't seem to care. She thought she was breaking the news. She thought I hadn't seen it coming because I hadn't said anything. I'd probably seen it before she had. I hadn't said anything because I'd been scared of giving her an opening. I felt sick to my stomach. I care about you, I said. As much as you could care about anything, she admitted. But you, I mean, sometimes you're fine, Cygnus. Sometimes you're wonderful to be around. But whenever anything gets the least bit intense, you just go away and leave this battle computer running your body, and I just can't deal with it anymore. I stared at the butterfly on the back of her hand, its wings flexed and folded, lazy and iridescent. I wondered how many of those tattoos she had. I'd seen 5 of them on different body parts, albeit only 1 at a time. I thought about asking her, but this didn't seem like the right moment. You can be so brutal sometimes, she was saying. I know you don't mean to be, but I don't know. Maybe I'm your pressure release valve or something. Maybe you have to submerge yourself so much on the job that everything just builds up and you need some kind of punching bag. Maybe that's why you say the things you do. She was waiting for me to say something now. I've been honest, I said. Yeah, pathologically. Have you ever had a negative thought that you haven't said out loud? Her voice trembled, but her eyes, for once, stayed dry. I guess it's as much my fault as yours, maybe more. I could tell you were disconnected from the day we met. I guess on some level I always saw it coming. Why even try, then? If you knew we were just going to crash and burn like this. Oh, Cygnus, aren't you the one who says that everyone crashes and burns eventually? Aren't you the one who says it never lasts? Mom and Dad lasted. Longer than this, anyway. I frowned, astonished that I'd even let the thought form in my head. Chels read the silence as a wounded one. I guess maybe I thought it could help, you know, help fix whatever made you so angry all the time.
The butterfly was starting to fade. I'd never seen that happen before. "Do you understand what I'm saying?" she asked.
"Sure. I'm a fixer-upper."
"Siri, you wouldn't even get a tweak when I offered. You were so scared of being manipulated, you wouldn't even try a basic cascade. You're the one guy I've met who might be truly, eternally unfixable. I don't know. Maybe that's even something to be proud of." I opened my mouth and closed it. She gave me a sad smile. "Nothing, Siri? Nothing at all? There was a time you always knew exactly what to say." She looked back at some earlier version of me. "Now I wonder if you ever actually meant any of it."
"That's not fair."
"No," she pursed her lips. "No, it isn't. That's not really what I'm trying to say. I guess it's not so much that you don't mean any of it. It's more like you don't know what any of it means." The color was gone from the wings. The butterfly was a delicate charcoal dusting, almost motionless. "I'll do it now," I said. "I'll get the tweaks. If it's that important to you, I'll do it now." "It's too late, Siri. I'm used up." Maybe she wanted me to call her back. All these words ending in question marks, all these significant silences. Maybe she was giving me the opportunity to plead my case, to beg for another chance. Maybe she wanted a reason to change her mind. I could have tried. "Please don't," I could have said. "I'm begging you. I never meant to drive you away completely, just a little, just to a safer distance. Please. In 30 long years, the only time I haven't felt worthless was when we were together." But when I looked up again, the butterfly was gone, and so was she, taking all baggage with her. She carried doubt and guilt for having led me on. She left believing that our incompatibility was no one's fault, that she'd tried as hard as she could, that even I had, under the tragic weight of all my issues. She left, and maybe she didn't even blame me, and I never even knew who'd made that final decision. I was good at what I did. I was so damned good, I did it without even meaning to. "My God, did you hear that?" Susan James bounced around the drum like a pronking wildebeest in the half-gravity. I could see the whites of her eyes from 90 degrees away. "Check your feeds, check your feeds, the pens." I checked, one scrambler afloat, the other still jammed into its corner. James landed at my side with a two-footed thump, wobbling for balance. "Turn the sound up." The hissing of the air conditioners, the clank of distant machinery echoing along the spine, Theseus' usual intestinal rumblings. Nothing else. "Okay, they're not doing it now." James brought up a split-screen window and threw it into reverse. "There," she pronounced, replaying the record with the audio cranked and filtered. In the right side of the window, the floating scrambler had drifted so that the tip of one outstretched arm brushed against the wall that adjoined the other pen. In the left side, the huddled scrambler remained unmoving. I thought I heard something just for an instant, the brief buzz of an insect, perhaps, if the nearest insect hadn't been 5 trillion kilometers away. "Replay that. Slow it down." A buzz, definitely. A vibration. Way down. A click train squirted from a dolphin's forehead. Farting lips. "No, let me." James bowled into Cunningham's headspace and yanked the slider to the left. Tick, tick, tick. Tick, tick, tick. Tick. Tick, tick, tick. Doppler down near absolute zero, it went on for almost a minute. Total elapsed real time was about half a second. Cunningham zoomed the split screen. The huddled scrambler had remained motionless, except for the rippling of its cuticle and the undulation of its free arms. But before I'd only seen 8 arms, and now I could make out the bony spur of a 9th peeking from behind the central mass. A 9th arm, curled up and hidden from view,
tick-tick-ticking while another creature casually leaned against the other side of the wall. Now there was nothing. The floating scrambler had drifted aimlessly back to the center of its enclosure. James's eyes shone. "We've got to check the rest of—" But Theseus had been watching and was way ahead of us. It had already searched the archives and served up the results. 3 similar exchanges over 2 days, ranging in duration from a tenth of a second to almost 2. "They're talking," James said. Cunningham shrugged, a forgotten cigarette burning down between his fingers. "So do a lot of things, and at that rate of exchange, they're not exactly doing calculus. You could get as much information out of a dancing honeybee." "That's nonsense, and you know it, Robert. What I know is that honeybees don't deliberately hide what they're saying. Honeybees don't develop whole new modes of communication configured specifically to confound observers. That's flexible, Robert. That's intelligent." "And what if it is, huh? Forget for a moment the inconvenient fact that these things don't even have brains. I really don't think you've thought this through."
"Of course I have."
"Indeed? Then what are you so happy about? Don't you know what this means?" Sudden prickling on the back of my neck. I looked around. I looked up. Eukosaristi had appeared in the center of the drum, eyes gleaming, teeth bared, watching us. Cunningham followed my gaze and nodded. "I'd wager it does."
This ends Disc 7.